so I opened the bottle and took a swig. The water wasn't as delicious as the water from the River of Dreams, but it would do. That river's seriously called the River of Dreams? I asked, shaking my head. It was more like the River of Nightmares.
The water from the river makes whoever drinks it pass out and have vivid nightmares of their worst fears,
Erebus explained.
All the fresh water in Kerberos comes from the river. Immortals don't need food and water to survive, but we do experience hunger and thirst, although at much greater intervals than mortals. Those locked in Kerberos have a choice. Dehydrate themselves to an unbearable level of thirst, or drink from the River of Dreams and descend into their worst nightmares. Both options are agonizing and are enough to drive anyone mad, especially after centuries of torture.
I nodded as I took in his words, grateful that he'd brought us water bottles so we wouldn't have to make that same choice. Although after those nightmares, I had no doubt that I would dehydrate myself forever if it meant never seeing those horrible visions again. How long was I asleep? I asked. Dark gray clouds still covered the sun, so it was impossible to tell what time it was. And where are my bow and arrows?
About 4 hours, he said. I got you and Chris onto the boat, and we've been floating down the river ever since. I stored your weapons inside the bench while you were asleep.
He stood up, opened the bench, and handed me my bow and quiver. I swung both of them over my back, feeling complete now that I had them back on me. Will Chris be up soon? I glanced at his sleeping body again.
He had more water than you, so he'll be asleep for longer,
Erebus answered, situating himself back down.
He should wake up relatively soon, though.
Good, I said. And then I glanced at Danielle, who had just taken another sip of her water. How'd you know not to drink from the river? I asked her. I know you knew. I saw the guilt in your eyes when I asked you why you weren't having anything to drink right before I fell asleep.
Erebus told me, she said. At first, I wanted to run to the river with you and Chris, but he pulled me back and told me to stop.
When I asked him why, he told me, but it was too late to stop you and Chris. You'd already started drinking the water.
You were all running fast, and I only had time to get to one of you,
Erebus added.
Danielle was closest.
It would have been a lot easier if you'd warned us about the water before we were running distance from the river, I said.
And I would have thought that you knew better than to run up to a river in a prison dimension designed to torture those inside of it and start drinking from it,
he said, his eyes sharp. I was thirsty, I said, although heat rose to my cheeks and I glanced down at my feet, since I knew he was right. He sat back and shook his head.
You should just be glad that it was a shallow part of the river and not a part where any creatures live,
he said.
If they'd sensed you, they would have pulled you under before you knew what was happening.
I shuddered, not wanting to think about the what-ifs. I'd already had enough torture for one day.
Do you want to know another reason why Danielle was the one I stopped?
Erebus asked, continuing before I could answer.
Because despite being thirsty, she was the one who paused to think about what she was doing.
I got the message the first time you said it, I said, glaring at him. What I did was stupid and impulsive, because I should have known better than to trust anything in Kerberos. And after the nightmares I just had from that water, you can sure as hell trust that I won't make that same mistake again. So there's no need to rub it in anymore, okay?
I wasn't rubbing it in, he said. I was just ensuring that my point got through. You were lucky that the only thing that happened to you was a few bad dreams. If you'd done something else, for instance, if you grabbed one of those fruits hanging from the trees overhead, it would be a whole lot worse.
What happens to people who eat the fruits? I looked up, noticing them for the first time. They resembled peaches, except they almost seemed to glimmer. My mouth watered at the sight of them.
You don't want to know.
He leaned back and rode faster, making it clear that he wasn't going to say any more. Fine, I said. But since we're on the topic of food, and you told us to let you know when we need anything, I guess I should tell you that I'm starving.
Now you're getting the hang of this.
He paused his rowing again to open his backpack and pull out a protein bar.
I've got enough in there for the entire trip. So whenever you're hungry, let me know.
I devoured the protein bar and was soon on to my second. Midway through eating it, Chris jolted up, his face twisted in horror. He scrambled to the side of the boat and retched over the edge.
Where am I?
He asked, once he'd gotten control of himself.
What just happened?
Erebus told him exactly what he'd explained to me after I woke up. Chris relaxed as he listened, apparently glad that what he'd just experienced had only been in his mind. I wondered what he'd seen, but I didn't ask, because of the same reason that I hadn't asked after the forest. Our experiences had been so personal. I didn't want to think about my nightmares, let alone tell them to someone else. Once Erebus finished his explanation, he handed Chris two protein bars, apparently figuring that Chris would be just as hungry as I was. Chris thanked him, and we all sat in silence as we ate, looking around as the boat floated down the river. Tree branches canopied above us, shielding us from the amber, overcast light that I'd come to associate with Kerberos, and making it possible to imagine that I was still on Earth. For the first time since arriving here, it actually felt peaceful. Until something whacked into the side of our boat with enough force to send us toppling to the floor. Chapter 26. What was that? I peered over the edge of the boat, trying to see what we'd crashed into. Something whammed into the opposite side, and if I hadn't been holding on to the edge, I would have gone flying into the water.
Merpeople,
Erebus muttered, at the same time as the boat got another whack. It rocked back and forth, as if caught in a storm, and we all held on tight to make sure we didn't go flying over the edge. He rowed faster, but it made no difference. The boat wasn't moving. A slimy, webbed hand reached over the edge, gripping onto mine with a surprising amount of strength. I reached into my quiver for the arrow I'd used on the fox and jammed it into the hand. It lost its grip, and it and the arrow flopped back into the water. Now that I was free, I pulled away and removed my knife from my boot, hurrying to the center of the boat. I held up the knife, ready to stab any merpeople who tried to attack. Get to the center, I yelled to the others. Quickly! They did as I said, and we huddled in a circle in the center, holding on to each other to keep steady. Chris and I each had our knives out, and Danielle had her sword. Webbed hands gripped at the sides, and then the merpeople surfaced, with hair like seaweed, bulbous faces, bulging eyes, and gaping mouths. They were nothing like the beautiful mermaids I used to imagine existing as a kid. They were creatures from nightmares, and they hissed and screeched at us, showing us their rows of sharp teeth and reaching forward with their slimy hands to try to pull us into the river.
Only their top halves can go above the surface. Their tails have to stay in the water, Erebus said. And whatever happens, don't let them pull you in. They won't try to take a bite out of you while you're still alive. But drowned mortals are their favorite food.
More and more of them surfaced, rocking the boat harder and harder. If we capsized, that was it. We would drown before we were able to fight them. So we would have to fight them from here. Since they were in close range, I shot one of them with my other used arrow, the shot going straight through its chest. The mer-creature gasped and sunk back into the river. I'd hoped that seeing that would scare the others away, but instead they screeched louder, apparently angered even more. Danielle swung the golden sword at the ones she could reach. The dismembered arms fell into the boat, but more of them were surfacing by the second, making her fighting futile. And I couldn't use my 3 remaining arrows now. There were too many of them, and not enough of us. Plus, if I used all my arrows now, I knew I would regret it later. Chris, I yelled at him. You need your lyre.
It's in the bench,
Erebus told us, and I groaned because there was no way to get to the bench while avoiding the merpeople's grasps. Chris must have realized that too, because he stared at the bench, his eyes wide in horror.
You have no idea how much I miss my power right now, he muttered. With the wind on our tail, we could blow away from here in seconds.
Well, you don't have your power, Danielle stated the obvious. So we have to do this another way. You get that lyre. I'll fight off any merpeople that try to stop you with my sword. They hurried toward the bench, and Danielle swung at any arms that reached out to them. Chris opened the bench and pulled out his lyre. But just as he did, a hand reached out from behind Danielle, grabbing her non-sword arm and pulling her and her sword down into the river. Chapter 27. I pulled out a crystal arrow and ran to the side of the boat, ready to shoot the merperson who'd taken Danielle. But the water was so dark that I couldn't see anything beneath the surface. I wanted to dive in after her, but I had no way of fighting those creatures in the water. Jumping in would be suicide. Then there was a splash behind me. I looked to see what had happened and saw Erebus's pack on the ground. The spot where he'd been standing was empty. He'd jumped in after Danielle. Another merperson reached for me, but just as it did, Chris started playing his lyre.
Stop attacking us,
he commanded, his voice fluid with the melody of the music.
Swim as far away from us as possible, and forget that you ever saw us.
The merpeople stopped rocking the boat and descended back down into the water. For the first time since they'd started attacking, all was still. I leaned over, trying to see what was happening with Danielle, but the water was too dark for me to tell.
Where's Erebus?
Chris asked, apparently only just noticing that he was gone.
He didn't get pulled in too, did he?
He jumped in after Danielle, I told him.
Good,
Chris sighed.
Then Danielle will be okay. Those creatures won't stand a chance against a god.
Seconds later, Erebus surfaced with Danielle by his side. She coughed and took a deep breath, her eyes panicked as she looked around.
They're gone?
She sputtered, taking in the scene.
You got to the lyre?
Yep.
Chris smiled and raised it up. Then he held out a hand to help Danielle onto the boat. She tumbled back on board, still gripping the golden sword. At least, despite everything, she'd had the sense to not let it go. I held out a hand to help up Erebus, but he scowled at me and climbed up easily on his own. Once they were both back on board, Danielle squeezed her hair, attempting to comb out the remaining seaweed. Which was strange, because back on Earth, where Danielle had her powers, she was able to dry herself off immediately. Now, as she sat there rubbing the water out of her eyes, she seemed so small and weak. Instead of having control over her element, it had control over her. Did you swallow any of the water? I asked her, wanting to be prepared in case she was about to fall into a nightmare-filled sleep.
Nope.
She shook her head and shivered, staring at the river.
That was terrifying, she said. I've gotten so used to being able to control water. It's my element. But here, it could have killed me. If Erebus hadn't jumped in to save me, it would have killed me.
Is that your way of saying thank you?
He asked. You saved my life, so I don't think thank you is strong enough to get across what I'm feeling right now, she said. But yes, although, and I don't want to sound ungrateful, because I'm not. I thought you weren't supposed to interfere with our journey. You're just supposed to be our guide.
I saw you and the sword go under, and my instinct was to jump.
He shrugged and sat back down with the oars to start rowing.
That sword's been in legends for thousands of years. It would be a shame to have such a glorious weapon lost in the bottom of a river in Kerberos.
So you jumped in to save the sword? Danielle eyed him up, as if making sure she was hearing this correctly. And while you were at it, you decided it wouldn't hurt to save me, too?
Something like that,
he said, rowing faster.
Are you disappointed? If so, I can throw you back in, and you can see how you fare with the merpeople on your own.
No. She scooted closer to the center of the boat, pulled her legs up to her chest, and wrapped her arms around them. I don't ever want to go in there again.
I didn't think so,
he said.
And just so you know, I wouldn't actually throw you back in there. I might only be your guide, but I do want to keep the three of you alive.
That would be easier if we weren't floating along a river full of monsters, I said. Nothing else is going to burst out of the water and try to drown us, right?
That wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for Chris's reaction to his nightmares,
Erebus said.
The creatures in the water don't notice the boat. It's made of wood, so it's part of nature. But the moment Chris vomited into the water, they were clued in that we were here. So as long as you keep all parts of yourself inside the boat for the rest of the trip, we'll be fine.
I didn't know, Chris defended himself. I thought I was doing you all a favor by aiming out of the boat.
We know, I told him. We don't blame you. I wanted to ask what he'd seen in his nightmares that caused such an extreme physical reaction when he woke up, but I held back. After all, the last thing I wanted to do right now was to think more about my nightmares by talking about them, and I assumed he felt the same. So we floated along in silence for a few minutes, looking around and taking in our surroundings. It was peaceful again, but I knew better than to think that would last.
How much longer will we be on the river? Danielle eventually asked. And where is it taking us?
We're traveling to the other side of the mountain,
Erebus answered.
It should take a few hours. The path that we'll be taking starts there, and it's only accessible from the river. The journey up that path will be exhausting, so even though time is limited, I recommend you get some rest now.
I shouldn't have been tired, since I'd just woken up. But the nightmares had hardly been restful. And after I lay down, it didn't take long until the boat rocked me to sleep. Chapter 28. I woke up shivering. I sat up, since it was too cold to sleep, and found Danielle already awake. She huddled in Erebus's sweatshirt, rubbing her hands over her arms to try warming up. Chris was still sleeping, although by the way he kept stirring, I had a feeling it wouldn't be long until the cold woke him up, too. I walked over to join Danielle and Erebus, hoping that being near the edge of the boat would block some of the wind. How long was I asleep? I whispered, not wanting to wake up Chris.
About 4 hours,
Erebus answered. Did you sleep at all? I asked him. I could take over rowing if you want to get some rest.
I'm a god,
he reminded me.
I don't need sleep.
Oh. I sat back, my teeth chattering from the cold. That must be nice.
It is, and it isn't,
he said.
Sometimes I find myself jealous of the way mortals can check out from the world for a while. Us gods don't have that luxury.
I would like to not need sleep, Danielle chimed in. Imagine how much you could get done with all that extra time. Everything you could learn and accomplish. It would be incredible.
I have no doubt that you would be a fierce goddess.
Erebus looked out at the river, appearing to be deep in thought.
But you must remember that time has a different meaning to gods than to mortals. Mortals get so much done in their short lives because they're constantly worried about running out of time. When time is endless, it's easy to lose that zeal. Everything can get put off until you realize that a century has gone by and you've accomplished nothing of any importance. I think that's part of why I'm helping the three of you now. When I look back on the past few centuries, they're as empty as the darkness I personify. Nyx pointed that out to me when she asked me to help you, and she was right. I've given in to indifference for far too long. It was about time that I'd do something, even something as strange as leading three mortals through a deadly hell dimension and ensuring that they return safely to Earth.
You're helping us save the world, Danielle said, placing her hand over his. Without you, we wouldn't have made it this far. We owe you our lives. Everyone in the world owes you their lives.
We haven't reached the end yet,
he reminded us.
There are still many challenges ahead.
We sat in silence for a few seconds, and I rubbed my hands over my arms, trying to get warm. I don't suppose you have another sweatshirt in that bag? I asked Erebus, still keeping my voice down so I didn't wake Chris.
Nope,
he said.
But I can give you my shirt if it'll help.
He stopped rowing and lifted his shirt above his head. His body was absolutely perfect, which wasn't surprising since he was a god. Even though I loved Blake, it was impossible to resist checking Erebus out. Not doing so would be like being in front of one of the most beautiful pieces of art in the world and not stopping to admire its beauty. Danielle's eyes were on Erebus, too, her cheeks red. She quickly pulled her gaze away from him and focused on the floor. But he smirked at her as he handed me his shirt. Apparently, he'd noticed her checking him out, too. Thanks. I took the shirt from him, wrapping it around my shoulders like a shawl. It did help guard me against the wind, and I stopped shivering as much. I guess gods don't get cold either?
We feel the cold, but it doesn't bother us like it does a mortal,
he said.
Extreme temperatures are uncomfortable, but they can't kill us. And since I'm your guide, it makes sense for me to sacrifice some personal comfort if it can help save your lives.
The line of what Erebus could and couldn't do to help us seemed to be getting blurrier as he spent more time with us. But I said nothing. It was kind of him to help. And it didn't seem wise to irritate a god who was on our side.
Maybe once Chris wakes up, he'll need your pants, Danielle joked.
Although from the way her eyes roamed down Erebus's body, I had a feeling that if that were the case, she wouldn't complain.
I heard that,
Chris mumbled from where he was curled up into a shivering ball.
And I might be cold, but I'd rather Erebus leave his pants on.
He sat up and stretched, raising his arms above his head. But then he winced, and he grabbed his shoulder, right where the fox had scratched him when we first tried going up the mountain. Since we have some time, you should let us have a look at that shoulder. I tried to be casual about it, since Chris didn't want us making a big deal about his injury. But the pain I'd seen on his face concerned me. If I could help, I had to try.
It's fine.
Chris sat straighter and forced a smile.
It's just a scratch.
I'm sure it is, I said. But we have time right now, and even scratches need to be cleaned. Just let me have a look, okay?
You're acting like you're a doctor.
Chris laughed. I may not be a doctor, but I liked to run around a lot outside when I was younger, I told him. I got scraped up constantly. I know how to clean up something like this. It's not a big deal. It'll just take a minute.
She's a daughter of Apollo,
Erebus chimed in.
Healing's in her blood. Fine,
Chris said.
It doesn't hurt that bad, but you can have a look.
He pulled his sleeve up, and I scooted over to him to check out the injury. The scratch wasn't huge, but the skin around it was red and puffy. I knew before touching it that it would be warm. Sure enough, it was. "You don't have any medical equipment in that bag, do you?" I asked Erebus. "Some antibiotic ointment, or antibiotics themselves?"
"No,"
Erebus said.
"And if the fox bit him, it wouldn't help anyway. They have a poison in their saliva that can't be treated by any medications on Earth."
"The fox scratched him," I clarified, turning to Chris so he could back me up. "Right?"
"The fox gave me a scratch on my shoulder."
Chris lowered his eyes, refusing to look at me.
"But it wasn't with his claws. It was with his teeth."
"Well, this is just great." Danielle sighed and pulled Erebus's sweatshirt tighter around her. "What are we supposed to do now? We know nothing about this poison. How long does it take to set in? What are its effects?"
"For immortals, the poison causes torture and pain," Erebus told us. "In mortals, it brings on a slow, painful death. It can take weeks, sometimes even months, to take full effect."
"That's good," I said, relief setting into my chest.
"Maybe I missed something, but can you explain to me how that's good?" Chris asked.
"We won't be in Kerberos for much longer," I reminded him. "A day or two at most, hopefully. Then we'll go back to Earth, and once we're there, I can use my power to heal you. You'll be fine." I looked back at Erebus so he could confirm it. He said nothing, his eyes dark. "What?" I asked him. "Is there something you're not telling us?"
"It's nothing."
He waved off my question, but the darkness didn't leave his eyes. I didn't feel like dealing with the god of darkness being broody right now. So instead, I poured some water from my bottle onto the sleeve of the shirt he'd given me and used it to clean the scratch on Chris's shoulder. "How does that feel?" I asked him. I didn't know if it would work, but I hoped it would at least cool it off, or maybe even remove some of the poison.
"A little better,"
he said, giving me a small smile.
"Thanks."
"Do you think the pain will affect your fighting?" I asked him. "And be honest with me. It's no good trying to be manly and brave about it if it'll just put you in danger."
"It's my right shoulder, and it feels stiff. So it might affect my fighting a bit,"
he admitted, rolling it around a few times.
"But I can still use my lyre."
"We have to remember what Apollo said about the lyre," I reminded him. "Every time you use it, it'll go more and more out of tune, until the magic is gone completely. We have no idea how many times you'll be able to use it before that happens. So we need to save it for when we're up against more creatures than we can possibly fight on our own. Like what just happened with the merpeople. If it's only one or two, or even three creatures, then Danielle has her sword and I have my arrows. We also all have our knives. We should use those weapons before you use the lyre."
"How many arrows do you have left?" Danielle asked.
3, all of them still unused, I answered. "And I know to be careful with how I use them."
"Good,"
Danielle nodded.
"So here's how I think we should go about this. Since the golden sword works as long as I have it, the first priority should always be to use the sword. If I need backup, fight with your knives if you can. If we're far away and the creature doesn't look like the type we can win against in close-up combat, then use an arrow. The lyre is only for if we're so overwhelmed by enemies that we have no other choice."
She looked at Chris, and then at me, her eyes full of determination.
"Got it?"
"Yes," I said, and Chris echoed my sentiment.
"Got it."
Chapter 29. An hour later, Erebus docked the boat at the start of an open, winding path. Out in the distance was the mountain, looking much farther away than it had when we'd first come to Kerberos through the portal.
"This is where we get off?" I asked,
trying to figure out how far away we were from the mountain. It was impossible to tell.
"Yes,"
he said. And the moment he spoke, thunder echoed overhead. Suddenly, the sky was pouring down buckets of rain, so thick that it obscured the view of the mountain. But the rain wasn't above our heads. It started at the bank of the river. Once we exited the boat, we would have no choice but to step into it, as if passing through a curtain. I stuck my hand out to feel the temperature of the rain. It was so cold that I gasped and pulled my hand back. How are we supposed to walk through that without getting hypothermia? I asked Erebus. It's freezing.
You might be mortals, but the three of you have the blood of the gods running through your veins,
he reminded us.
You can withstand far more extreme situations than humans. Think about Antarctica, when you were coming back from Kioni's ice palace. You rode through negative 40-degree weather without proper attire and still managed to make it to the South Pole station alive. No human could have done that.
We were barely alive, I reminded him. If I wasn't able to heal myself and the others, we probably would have died.
If you were human, your death would have happened before you were able to use your power at all,
Erebus said.
Yes, the hike to the mountain will be uncomfortable. But as long as you remain focused on the purpose of this mission, it will not kill you. Now, as promised, I'll lead the way.
He dropped his oars and stepped out into the rain. The three of us followed him. The rain poured down, so cold that it felt like ice on my skin. But we had to get through this. And so, I gathered my focus, remembering what Erebus had said about the blood of the gods giving us strength, and forced myself forward. Chapter 30. I wasn't sure how long we walked through the storm. It felt like hours. And since it was one long plane, there were no places to stop to take cover. We had no option but to trek on. It wasn't close to as cold as in Antarctica, but the rain was so icy that I suspected it was nearly freezing outside. My body hurt from shivering so much, and every step felt heavy. I assumed that making us uncomfortable, but not to the level where it killed us, was on purpose. It wouldn't be much fun to torture creatures in the Hell Dimension if those creatures died. My time here so far had taught me that the worst type of torture wasn't the type that killed you. It was the type that barely allowed you to go on alive, so that you could live and be conscious through the anguish and the pain. We continued along the path, saying nothing. Not that I could speak, given how much I was shivering. I was soaked to the bone. If we ever made it out of this rain, I doubted I would ever feel dry again. All that kept me going were thoughts of my family at home, counting on me, and of Blake, up at the top of that mountain, needing our help. Without that drive, I surely would have collapsed and succumbed to the cold by now. Then, when I was seriously contemplating falling into a heap on the ground and curling up into a ball until the rain stopped, the downpour lightened.
I don't want to speak too soon,
Chris said, his teeth chattering.
But does it seem like the rain is letting up?
Yes. Danielle looked ahead and she brightened. Out there, she pointed. Look, it's not raining. As we'd been walking, I'd been keeping my eyes on my feet. It helped me focus on the task of putting one foot in front of the other. But when I looked forward, I saw what Danielle was pointing at. The base of the mountain was within sight, and right ahead of it, the rain came to a sudden stop. Filled with newfound vigor, I bolted into a run, eager to escape the rain. Danielle and Chris ran as well. Erebus turned into a shadow and disappeared. I assumed he'd had enough of the rain and was going to meet us at the place where it stopped. I was right. When we reached the end of the rain, Erebus waited in front of a looming gate at the start of the mountain. He was dry, which wasn't fair. but it was miraculously warmer here, so I was in no place to complain.
If you can travel by shadow, why'd you stay in human form when we were walking through the rain?
Danielle asked him.
I thought it would boost morale if I endured the journey with you.
He shrugged.
It was less comfortable, but I knew I would survive.
And you knew we would survive too, right?
Chris asked.
Since we have the blood of the gods in our veins?
I was pretty sure of it.
He sounded more sure than that before we'd started off, but I ignored him for now. Instead, enjoying my time in the sun. This was the first place we'd been in Kerberos where the sun shined through the clouds. The sun here was dimmer than the one on Earth, more of a dark amber than a bright white yellow, but it warmed my skin just the same. I held my face up and closed my eyes, relishing in its rays. After those hours of trekking through freezing cold rain, it felt amazing to take a few seconds to breathe and take in the light. For the first time since arriving in Kerberos, things finally felt like they were looking up.
You guys?
Chris asked, the panic in his voice breaking through my thoughts.
What's that?
I opened my eyes and saw three bird humanoid creatures. Harpies. Flying through the air and heading straight toward us. Chapter 31.
Watch out!
Danielle screamed, unsheathing her sword and readying herself to fight. I did the same with my bow, although I hoped I wouldn't have to use any arrows, since I only had three left. But the harpies didn't attack. Instead, they landed a few feet ahead of us, their yellow eyes studying us suspiciously. I kept an arrow strung, warning them not to come closer, but didn't shoot. Danielle and Chris kept their weapons raised as well.
You come from Earth, the harpy in the center finally said. Descendants of the gods.
She looked at me specifically, observing the golden bow.
Judging from Apollo's weapon in your hand, you're the daughter of Apollo, the one attempting to reseal the portal between Earth and this hellish prison world.
How do you know who I am? I asked, keeping my arrow aimed straight at her heart. I couldn't miss, and she must have known that too, or she probably would have attacked by now.
The Titan goddess Phoebe prophesied your existence centuries ago.
The harpy smiled as much as she could through her beak.
She said, led by Nyx, the daughter of Apollo will ignite elemental powers in four other descendants of gods, and with the guidance received from the Book of Shadows, the five of them will work together to seal the portal to Kerberos.
You've known about me all this time? I was so shocked that I couldn't move. But it explained why so many monsters had attacked me after they'd escaped Kerberos. They wanted to stop the prophecy from coming true.
It was infuriating to be trapped in this place, unable to interfere, she said. But of course, we knew about you. How else would my sister have known to search you out after she escaped?
I swallowed, barely able to breathe. The harpy I'd killed in the cave, the one who had kidnapped Becca and I'd killed using black energy. Was this creature's sister? There was no way this confrontation could end without a fight.
You met her,
the harpy observed. I hesitated, and she added,
Don't try denying it. I can see it in your eyes. And I wouldn't recommend shooting me, either.
She eyed up my arrow, not looking scared in the slightest.
I can see from looking at your quiver that you only have three crystal arrows left. And you haven't even started up the mountain yet. Using them now would be a grave mistake, don't you think?
She was right, but I didn't want to admit it, so I held my ground and said nothing. She wouldn't dare step any closer if she thought there was a chance I would shoot.
My sister was determined to destroy you, the harpy continued, apparently taking my silence as agreement. She said it wouldn't take long, and that once the job was finished, she would come back to retrieve us, and we would escape into Earth together. We waited and waited, but she never came back.
She eyed me up, her gaze glinting with suspicion.
All I ask of you, young demigod, is to tell us what happened to her. Once you do, we'll let you through the gates. I recommend you listen, one of the other harpies said from behind her. Without us letting you through, the only way to open those gates is if we're dead.
I thought this was supposed to be the easy way up the mountain, Danielle muttered, glaring at Erebus. He, of course, smirked and said nothing. So she turned away from him and refocused on the harpies, her sword poised and ready to kill. You want to know what happened to your sister? I asked the harpy, leveling my gaze with hers and putting as much confidence into my voice as I could manage. I killed her, just like I'm about to do to you. With that, I pulled back on the string of my bow and shot the crystal arrow straight through her heart. Chapter 32. The arrow killed her instantly. I don't even think she had time to realize what had happened. She toppled to the ground, and dust billowed out around her, so thick that it hid her body. The other two harpies squawked and ran toward me. Their eyes flashed with anger, and their wings expanded, giving them more speed. Danielle sprinted toward one of them, swinging her sword in a perfect arc that chopped the harpy's head clean off. But the other harpy was moments away from running into me. I didn't have time to reach for my knife, so I grabbed another arrow, strung it through my bow, and shot it through her heart. She toppled to the ground in front of me, and all was still. So, that went well. I took a few steps forward so I was standing over the harpy. Her back was toward the sky, and the arrow hadn't come through. It must have lodged itself in her heart. I leaned down to roll her over, but she was nearly three times my size, so heavy that she didn't budge. I could use some help over here, I called over my shoulder. Chris ran over and positioned himself over the harpy. When I asked for help, I was hoping that Erebus would come, but he'd walked to the gate and was running his fingers over the metal. Danielle stood over the harpy she'd killed, using its feathers to clean her sword. Are you sure you're up for this? I asked Chris. I'm sure one of the others can help.
I have a scratch, he said. I'm not an invalid, at least not yet.
We worked together to roll over the harpy, maneuvering her so she was on her back. Her eyes stared up at the sky, the shock of her final moment plastered across her face. The arrow stuck straight out of her chest, and I pulled it out, studying the dulled crystal. It was covered in blood. Following Danielle's idea, I used the harpy's feathers to clean it off. Once it was as clean as it was going to get, I stood back up and placed it into my quiver, catching sight of Chris massaging his shoulder. His eyes met mine, and he lowered his hand. Are you sure you're okay? I asked him.
I'm fine,
he assured me, flexing his hand at his side.
Come on, let's get the other arrow.
The first harpy, the sister of the one I'd killed in the cave, had landed on her side. The arrow stuck out into the air. We didn't have to turn her over, but Chris hurried ahead of me and placed his foot on her stomach to hold her still, yanking the arrow out of her chest. He used his left hand, not his dominant one, since his right shoulder was the one that had been injured. I didn't know what he was trying to prove, but I said nothing, since the task was already done. He rubbed the arrow on his jeans to clean off the excess blood and walked over to me, placing it into my hand.
Use these next time, he said,
his eyes serious.
You only have one active arrow left. You have to save it for when you really need it.
I know, I said. But that harpy was going to kill me if I didn't kill her on this first shot. I had to use one of the crystal arrows.
What about the first harpy?
He asked.
Did you have to use one of the active arrows on her, too?
I didn't want to miss.
You're a daughter of Apollo,
he reminded me.
You don't miss.
That's not entirely true, I said. I missed when we were fighting Medusa.
How could I forget?
He smirked.
You got me straight in the other shoulder. But that doesn't count, because in case you don't remember, Ethan spiked our drinks with gray energy that night. All of our powers were off.
Which is exactly my point, I said. Our powers were off then, just like they are here in Kerberos. None of us can access our elemental powers. Why should my ability to shoot be any different?
Because your power to shoot isn't an elemental power,
he said.
It's inherited. You shoot like you do because you're Apollo's daughter. Being in Kerberos can't take that away from you.
Maybe. I shoved the used arrow into my quiver, since looking at it reminded me that I only had one active arrow left. But I didn't want to test it out when my life was on the line.
So let's test it out now,
he said. Are you serious? I asked, even though I could tell from his impish smile that he was. What would I even shoot? There aren't any trees around here to use for target practice.
Hey, Erebus!
Chris yelled to the god, who was still over at the fence, deep in discussion with Danielle.
Come over here for a second.
Annoyance crossed over his face, but he disappeared into a cloudy shadow, reappearing next to us a few seconds later.
You called,
he said, his tone dripping with sarcasm.
I need your help with something,
Chris said.
What would happen if you were shot with one of the used arrows?
He glanced up at the sky, contemplating the question.
It would hurt for a second, he said. Then I would remove the arrow, heal, and pulverize whoever had the nerve to shoot me.
Stop being ridiculous, I said to Chris. I'm not going to shoot Erebus. Danielle arrived at our side, needing more time than Erebus to get there since she actually had to use her legs.
What are you talking about? She asked me. Why would you shoot Erebus?
Relax, I told her, unable to stop myself from laughing. I'm not shooting anyone.
But you need to shoot something,
Chris said. And then he turned to them to explain.
Nicole's avoiding shooting the used arrows because she's afraid she's going to miss.
I'm not afraid. I placed my hands on my hips and glared at him. I'm being cautious.
Because you're afraid that being in Kerberos made you lose your ability to shoot, along with your ability to heal.
He stood straighter and crossed his arms over his chest, not backing down. Fine. I grabbed a used arrow from my quiver and slid the bow off my back. What should I shoot? Erebus reached for the dead harpy at our feet, grabbed her wing, and pulled her up to standing position, as if she weighed nothing.
Aim for the same spot you shot her last time,
he instructed, holding on to the monster so she didn't fall down.
Her heart. I doubt your aim will be so terrible that you'll miss and shoot me instead. If it is, then at least you know I won't die. And I promise I won't pulverize you.
Well, at least there's that, I said, spinning and walking away to give myself room to shoot.
Although I can't promise that I won't tell Apollo,
Erebus added.
I hate to think what he'd do if he found out that a child of his missed her target that badly.
It won't be an issue. I positioned myself 50 feet away from the harpy and strung the arrow through my bow. Because I won't miss. I steadied my bow and eyed up the red dot on the harpy's chest where the arrow had pierced her skin the first time. Erebus watched me, an annoyingly arrogant smirk on his face. I didn't know if he was smirking because he thought I was going to miss, or because he was confident I could do this. I had to prove the latter, because he was right. It would be humiliating if I missed. And so, zeroing in on the target, I pulled back on the string and sent the arrow flying toward the harpy. Chapter 33.
Bullseye,
Erebus announced, dropping his hold on the harpy and letting her crash back onto the ground. I jogged back over to where they were all standing, leaning forward to inspect the shot. That's not a bullseye, I said, yanking the arrow out of the harpy's chest. If it were a bullseye, there would still only be one hole. But there's not. There are two.
Seriously?
Danielle rolled her eyes. They're like an inch apart, and you were 50 feet away.
Seems like a bullseye to me.
It was a good shot, I agreed, but not a bullseye.
You children of Apollo are so picky,
Erebus said.
I told you to aim for the heart. Your arrow hit the heart. Thus, a bullseye.
At least you know you haven't lost your ability to shoot,
Chris said.
So save the last active arrow for an impossible shot, all right?
I will, I promised, adding the used arrow back into my quiver. With only 3 arrows left, and only one of them active, I would have to be careful to use the 2 used arrows only in situations where it would be possible for me to retrieve them.
Now that that's finished, you both need to hear what Erebus and I were discussing by the gate,
Danielle said, turning her attention to the god.
Do you want to tell them, or should I?
You go ahead,
Erebus said,
since it was your idea to ask in the first place.
Okay.
Danielle flipped her hair over her shoulder, and I had a feeling that she'd planned on being the one to tell us even before she asked Erebus.
First, let me explain how I got to asking the question in the first place. You see, when anyone dies on Earth, they go to Hades, the underworld of Earth. So after the harpies died, I wondered, what happens when creatures die in Kerberos?
Does Kerberos have an underworld of its own?
It's a good question, I said. And then I turned to Erebus. Do creatures killed here even go anywhere? Or are they just gone forever?
No creature, mortal or immortal, is ever gone forever,
Erebus said.
The physical form may perish, but the soul is everlasting and cannot be destroyed. And Danielle is correct that Kerberos has its own version of the underworld. A dark, miserable place, where the soul takes no form. It floats alone in the shadows for all eternity, conscious and aware that it's powerless to escape.
What happens to the creatures who die here who don't deserve a place like that? I asked. Is there somewhere else they can go? Someplace more similar to heaven?
Kerberos was created by the original primordial deity, Chaos, to imprison the most dangerous creatures on Earth,
he explained.
In the Second Rebellion, we, the primordial deities, knew that if the Titans won, there would be no future for this planet. And so, Nyx filled a comet with her magic and sent it soaring across the sky, opening the portal to Kerberos and gifting the Olympians with enough power to force all those who rebelled against them inside. Then, once the comet disappeared, the portal sealed. We hoped it would remain sealed forever. But as you know, that's not what happened.
Clearly, Danielle said. Do you even know how we're supposed to seal the portal? Because I know we need to seal it, but we still haven't been told how to do that.
You'll find out in time,
he said.
But I deviated from your original question. The short answer is, every creature in Kerberos is here for a reason. Once killed here, they have no opportunity for a pleasant afterlife because they do not deserve one.
What if one of us dies in Kerberos?
Chris asked.
We're not prisoners here. Would we get sent to the underworld here too?
Erebus gazed up at the mountain and took a deep breath.
When Chaos created Kerberos,
I don't believe he took it into consideration that any creature would enter this world by choice,
he finally said.
It's never been done before.
What about those born in Kerberos? I asked. Like the Cyclops who escaped through the portal. Why should he be punished when he couldn't have even been alive during the Second Rebellion?
I assure you, he was alive in the Second Rebellion,
Erebus said.
When in Kerberos, no creature is able to age or procreate. Most of the Cyclopes actually supported the Olympians in the rebellion, but there are extremists in all groups. And as such, there was a small subsect of Cyclopes who supported the Titans. The Cyclops who escaped was part of the sect. Do not be deceived by his age. Cyclopes age slower than humans. Though he appeared young, he was actually older than you. If Ethan hadn't used Medusa's head on him, he was most likely planning on doing something equally bad, if not worse, to you once you had him in that cave.
At least I don't feel guilty anymore about having him turned to stone, I said, remembering how I'd hesitated before Ethan had brought out the head.
Ethan was correct in what he did,
Erebus agreed. I nodded, remembering the Cyclops' final scream as he turned to stone, which of course reminded me of Kate's final scream, which made my heart hurt for my lost friend. I wanted to believe that her final moment wasn't painful, but given the agony in her scream, it was impossible to convince myself that that was true.
So we have to make sure we stay alive while we're in Kerberos,
Chris said, bringing me back into focus.
Not that I was planning on anything else, but we can't, under any circumstances, end up in the underworld here.
I shivered, not wanting to think about the consequences if that were to happen. At least on Earth, I knew that when I died, I would be reunited with my loved ones in the afterlife. Not even having that to comfort me was unimaginable.
The possibility of ending up in the underworld here scares me too, Danielle said, her voice surprisingly soft.
Then she stood straighter and rested her hand on the grip of her sword, her eyes strong with determination.
So we can't let it happen. We have to get up that mountain, get the head, stop Ethan, and then all of us, Blake included, have to get out of here as fast as possible. Because the sooner we're back to Earth, the safer we'll be.
So let's keep going, I said, turning toward the mountain. Blake was up there, and we were going to find him. I refused to settle for anything less. We have no time to waste.
Chapter 34. Erebus opened the gate, and we all walked through, starting up the winding path that ascended the mountain. Surprisingly, nothing jumped into our way to try to kill us, and the temperature was neither too hot nor too cold. A slight breeze blew against my skin, cooling off the places where I'd been bitten and stung by the wasps. I didn't want to say anything, because I was sure that once I did, something would jump out at us and prove me wrong. But this area was actually pretty nice. I could only assume that after the Badlands, the Whispering Forest, the River of Dreams, the merpeople who tried to drown and devour us, the freezing rain that nearly wore us to exhaustion, and the harpies who wanted us dead, that most people didn't make it this far. So the mountain didn't need to set up any torturous traps. If we didn't have Erebus as our guide, I doubted that we would have made it this far either.
Is it just me, or is this place too good to be true?
Chris asked, also looking around as if waiting for something to attack.
This area of Kerberos is deceptive,
Erebus warned us.
We have to keep moving, and we can't stop until we reach the point where the grass is dead.
What happens if we stop? I didn't plan on stopping, since we needed to get up the mountain as quickly as possible. But still, I was curious.
A lightning bolt will strike you down and cause you more pain than ever imaginable.
Oh, I glanced up at the amber sky. Good to know. There were a few wispy clouds, but nothing that looked like it could create lightning. Still, I picked up the pace just to be safe. We walked for about 3 hours, making sure to keep moving. Finally, the grass ended abruptly and turned to dirt, forming a clear line along the land. I stepped over the line, taking a moment to uncap my water and take a sip. Then the wind blew from up ahead, and I smelled something strange, something metallic and rusty. "Do you all smell that?" I asked, sniffing the air some more.
"Yeah," Chris said. "It smells like death."
"Not death." I shuddered at the idea of whatever we were approaching. "It smells like blood." The wind stopped blowing, so the smell wasn't coming at us anymore. But the remains of the scent lingered in my nose. It was definitely blood. Danielle stopped walking and eyed up Erebus.
"I'm guessing you know what's ahead," she said. "So if you want to warn us, now would be a good time."
"We're approaching the Red River."
He faced the breeze and took a deep breath, not reacting to the smell at all.
"Crossing will be difficult, but I trust that you will figure out how to do so successfully."
"Why will it be difficult?" I pressed.
"That's up for you to discover yourselves."
He continued forward without bothering to look back at us. With nowhere else to go, and since we clearly weren't about to get an actual answer, we followed his lead. The smell grew stronger until I could taste the blood in the back of my throat. The air was hot and sticky, and when we turned a corner, I saw it. A river of bubbling blood. It was like the blood was boiling, evaporating into the air. But that wasn't the strangest part, because around the river were horses, although they weren't like any horses I'd ever seen. Their bottom halves were horses, but their necks morphed into the top halves of humans.
"Centaurs," Danielle breathed. The moment she spoke, one of their heads twisted in our direction.
He caught sight of us and smiled.
"Humans," he said.
And before I knew what was happening, all of the centaurs galloped toward us, forming a circle around us so we couldn't escape. I readied myself to grab my knife from my boot, although it wouldn't be much of a defense against the centaurs. There must have been 30 of them in all. They licked their lips, digging their front hooves into the ground. The four of us clustered together in the center of the circle, tensed and prepared to fight. The centaur that spotted us walked toward us, staring down at us as if we were bugs he wanted to squash.
"Not humans,"
he said, taking a few deep sniffs of the air around us.
"I smell magic in your blood."
"We don't want any trouble," Danielle said, although she reached for the handle of her sword and wrapped her fingers around it.
"We just need to cross the river."
"Cross the river?"
The centaur laughed, and the others laughed along with him.
"Why do you wish to cross the river?"
"Our friend was taken to the top of the mountain," I said, pointing up at where the peak of the mountain disappeared into the clouds. "We need to get up there so we can help him escape." I purposefully left out information about Medusa's head. Since these creatures were locked in Kerberos, I doubted they would support our mission to seal the portal. The last thing we needed was to give them a reason to want to kill us on the spot.
"That's unfortunate,"
the centaur said.
"If your friend was taken to the top of the mountain, he's surely already dead."
He paced around in front of us, eyeing us suspiciously.
"Where did you say you were from again?"
he asked. We didn't say where we were from, but he knew that, so I said nothing. Neither did Danielle and Chris.
"It's no matter."
He waved away the question.
"Because do you know what we do to anyone who trespasses on our land?"
"No,"
Chris said, meeting the centaur's gaze without flinching.
But I have a feeling you're about to tell us.
The centaur stopped pacing, and he stared at us.
The first thing we do is kill them,
he said simply.
Then we slash their necks and hold them upside down over the edge of the river, so their blood can drain into the water. Once their body is empty of blood, we feast on the parts that remain, bones and all.
He smiled, showing off his sharp teeth.
Is that it?
Chris asked, not looking scared in the slightest.
What's your problem?
The centaur sneered at him.
Do you want to die, boy? Not particularly.
The centaur's eyes glinted with amusement.
Then this isn't your lucky day, is it? Actually, I think it is.
Chris smiled and reached for the golden lyre, starting to play. Each note rang clearly through the air, filling a massive amount of space for such a small instrument. All of the centaurs were suddenly still, their eyes glazed over as they listened to the music.
None of you are going to kill us,
Chris continued, his voice melodic and hypnotizing.
You're going to take us across the river, and once we're gone, you'll return here and forget you ever met us.
The centaur, who had previously threatened to kill us, nodded, his face slack.
Our biggest men will jump you across the river,
he agreed.
Once we've brought you to safety and you're out of our sight, we'll return here and forget we ever met you.
That's what I'm talking about.
Chris stopped playing the lyre and swung it around his back.
Kneel down, horsey,
he said to the centaur.
Because you're my ride.
Chapter 35. We each hopped on a centaur, and I held on tight to its mane as the creature ran toward the river, gaining speed before he jumped. We soared through the air, landing smoothly on the other side. They led us off their backs, and once we dismounted, they turned away, as if they'd forgotten our existence. We ran over the crest of the hill, wanting to get as far away from them as possible.
Nice job, Danielle told Chris, once the Red River had disappeared behind us. I was about to tell you to use the lyre, but you pulled it out before I could.
There were too many of them, and not enough of us,
Chris said, reaching for his injured shoulder and massaging it.
The lyre seemed like the safest bet.
Since we're out of the lightning zone, do you want to stop so I can check your cut? I asked him. You could probably use a cleaning after all that walking.
I'm fine.
He dropped his hand back to his side.
I was just holding on to the centaur too tightly. It's not bothering me anymore.
Okay, I said, not wanting to push it. Still, I worried. I knew that Erebus said it would take weeks, maybe even months, for the poison to work its way through Chris's body. But magical fox venom wasn't really an exact science. We needed to get out of Kerberos as quickly as possible so I could heal him, which meant we had to keep heading toward the mountain. But the further we walked, the hotter it became. What little bits of vegetation there were disappeared, until only the occasional cactus remained. The sun shone down on us as if we were inside an oven, and it was trying to cook us alive. I'd always been that one person who never got sunburned, but now my skin felt hot and tight. When I looked at my arm, it was a bright, fiery red. Chris and Danielle were also burned on every place where their skin was exposed. Erebus, of course, was unaffected. As we continued on, the desert played tricks on us. Every so often, a beautiful fountain of water would pop up out of nowhere. But we ignored them, since the source of all the drinkable water in Kerberos was the River of Dreams. If I didn't have my water bottle, I would have succumbed to drinking the water from the fountains and found myself passed out in a nightmarish sleep for hours, the unforgiving sun beating down relentlessly on my unconscious body. All I could do was remind myself to put one foot in front of the other and trek on,
But the heat wasn't the only thing that made that difficult. Because gnats buzzed everywhere, seeking moisture in my eyes and my mouth. No matter how much I swatted at them, they refused to stay away. I splashed water from my bottle onto my clothes, and that provided enough distraction for the gnats that not as many of them swarmed my eyes and mouth. But no amount of water I drank could chase away the heat. It felt like I would get so burned that my skin would peel straight off my body. And that probably would be more pleasant than the pain I was in now. Eventually, I stopped and stared up at the hot amber sun. "When's this going to end?" I said, looking at Erebus for an answer. I sounded whiny, but I didn't care. I just wanted to get out of this heat. "The sun has to go down eventually, right?"
"The sun never sets in the desert here," he said,
which explained why it hadn't moved from the highest point in the sky since we'd set foot in this area hours ago.
"If you stop to rest, it just means you'll be in the sun for longer, which will make it worse long term. So we need to keep going."
"But for how long?" I repeated.
"Not much longer."
"That's not a real answer," Danielle chimed in, emptying the remaining water from her bottle onto her face.
Seconds later, the bottle was magically full again. She dumped that on her head, too. Her hair was wet, as if she'd just gotten out of the shower. But given the lack of humidity, it would be dry again in less than 5 minutes.
"An hour or two tops," Erebus said. "You'll all survive. So stop complaining, and let's go."
Chapter 36. After what felt like much longer than 2 hours, we reached the end of the desert. It ended abruptly, just like all other places we'd traveled through since arriving in Kerberos. One moment, we were following the barren path. Then we turned around a massive boulder and saw a thriving jungle up ahead. I ran for the trees, unable to get under their canopied cover fast enough. The moment I reached the shade, I sat on the ground and leaned against one of the trunks, guzzling down as much water as I could manage. The water never truly quenched my thirst in the desert, but now I finally felt hydrated again. The air around me was humid and misty, although the mist wasn't nearly as thick as in the Whispering Forest, so we were still able to see. It cooled my skin, making the burn hurt less than it had when exposed straight to the sun.
"Is there anything we can use in here for our sunburn?" Danielle asked, poking through a colorful variation of plants. "Aloe, perhaps?"
"Don't put anything from these plants on your skin,"
Erebus warned us, and Danielle pulled her hand back, stepping away from the greenery.
"There's no predicting what they could do, but given where we are, I doubt it would be anything good."
"Where exactly are we?" I asked, looking up at the trees. They were gigantic compared to any trees I'd ever seen, their branches and leaves at least 3 times the size of any on Earth. Erebus looked at me as if I'd lost my mind.
"We're in Kerberos,"
he said. "I know that," I glared at him. "But what area of Kerberos is this? What type of torture should we expect while we're here?"
"This is the jungle," Erebus told us. "Like everywhere else in Kerberos, don't consume any food or drink while here. Many variations of food grow here, and while they will nourish, each one will come with a different cost. But the food and drink isn't what keeps most people out of the jungle."
He paused to scan the area, as if expecting something to jump out at us at any second. I stood up and grabbed my bow, wanting to be ready in case anything attacked. I looked at Erebus to continue, but he said nothing.
"Since you clearly want one of us to ask, I'll do the honor," Danielle said,
rubbing her hands against her jeans to get rid of any residue from the plants she'd touched.
"What keeps most people out of the jungle?"
"The dragons,"
Erebus said simply, tossing us each a protein bar and turning to continue along the path. "Dragons?" I repeated, opening my protein bar and hurrying after him. Danielle and Chris did the same. "The same kind of dragons who flew Ethan and Blake up the mountain?"
"Helios's solar dragons,"
Erebus nodded.
"They're the only dragons who live in Kerberos. They're the final part of your journey up the mountain. You see, we've taken the path nearly to the end. As you saw when you arrived to Kerberos, the mountain shoots straight up through the clouds. Those clouds are the mist you currently see around.